Authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers.
Welcome, meanderers, puzzle solvers, memory keepers, deep observers, and marvel seekers. Today's topic is one I think I can safely say is near and dear to both my own and my co-host Grant Faulkner's heart, because we've talked about it in episodes past, about rebels and defiance and why it's important to march to the beat of your own drummer sometimes. So Grant, today's theme is all about breaking the rules. So what does that conjure up for you?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite eras of my own life is when I was in high school as a teen rebel there, at least for a couple of years, and a punk rocker in particular. And I was a very odd punk rocker because I grew up in a small town in Iowa where there wasn't a big punk rock culture, to say the least. You know, it was just me and three or four of my friends. And we essentially existed to shock people. We loved breaking the rules and really shaking people up. And we were just, you know, I think we were just very dissatisfied by the state of the world. And we hated all the norms that were being expected of us. And I remember going to punk concerts in Des Moines or Iowa City. And literally every one of the punk rockers in Iowa, there were exactly 103 of us, would be there. So we actually had this nice supportive community of freaks, which was actually a great training to be an artist, because creativity is all about flipping conventions and remixing things and challenging norms. And you know, I think like being a punk in high school, you know, informed another favorite era of my life when I first became a writer. And as much as I was trying to learn all the rules of how to write a good story, I also loved to think about ways to subvert those rules as well. How about you, Brooke? Were you a teen rebel?
Yeah, no. In fact, I was quite the opposite. I don't know that we would have been friends in high school, Grant.
I allowed myself to have friends with non-rebels.
Okay. You might have shocked my consciousness. I'm not sure. And I ran cross country. I was very concerned about my grade point average. I was definitely a preppy kid. And I didn't even get drunk for the first time until well into college. And I didn't have my first boyfriend until I was college. So, you know, I was one of those good kids. And other than this one time that I famously took my mom's car out for a spin in the middle of the night with my friends. And I think we just, you know, went down to the beach to look at the water. So these days, I think I'm a mix of a rule breaker and a rule follower. And I certainly get defiant about things. You know, I'm bad about following the rules when it comes to driving and parking and crossing the street and things like that, which probably just speaks to my impatience more than anything. But when it comes to the world of writing and publishing, I'm totally into rule breaking and following the rules. And it is complicated, right? Because I love it when people are experimental with form. I appreciate authors who think outside the box when it comes to craft. I value creativity in book publishing and book design. But I also like people to work within the parameters of what's expected professionally. And I think I've said this in a previous episode, you know, that I wrote in my first book, What's Your Book, about the difference between being a visionary and a renegade. And it speaks to exactly that. I love visionaries. I love people who can see things that might be risks and who take those risks. But I also don't like it when authors try to get too clever or when they break the rules to the detriment of their own work. And I guess the problem with this whole conversation is that can be kind of subjective. And I also think that there are a lot of authors out there whose work I would qualify as problematic for having broken the rules, but they don't know they broke the rules. And that makes the conversation kind of tough too.
Yeah, I agree. It's a tough balancing act. I definitely defined myself as an experimental writer early on, but I found that it's easy to be too experimental, to subvert narrative forms to the extent that you're essentially just writing for yourself because your story is too hard to read. And going back to punk rock, you know, there were some bands that just ended up creating a mayhem of noise without any structure or meaning. It was just like a guttural yell that was unpleasant to listen to and led nowhere. So I always thought the goal shouldn't be to write a story that's impenetrable or indecipherable or horribly unpleasant. But I think some fiction and poetry, you know, can veer in that direction, unfortunately. But it is subjective, as you said. That said, you know, I love fiction that breaks the rules and unearths new worlds. I think all good stories do this in some ways. They shock us, jar us, prick us, shake us up. And then the world is presented with a different twist and we're changed as a result. So that's part of the goal. And I should say that I believe we need those extreme brave rule breakers who push the extremes in order to find that balance between experimentation and convention. You know, we need to dare ourselves on the page, in other words, and never become complacent.
Yeah, such a good point. And the reason that we're even talking about breaking the rules in the first place is because we have our guest, Abigail Thomas, today. And I actually had the honor of hosting her at She Writes University in the past. And I was intrigued by all these things that she was just throwing out the window. You know, she did not care for convention, things like craft and timelines and themes and structure. And because I teach these things, that's the exact opposite of how I approach work with my students or when I'm coaching. But there was something then and now that delights me about her irreverence. And her work is so stunningly beautiful that part of me feels like, well, yeah, you know, you can throw away the rule book if you can write like Abigail Thomas. And so with students and people who are learning, I think you have to also ask yourself the question, you know, do I get to throw away the rules because I understand these things in a way that's going to be new and different and, you know, open up new ways of thinking about craft or form or whatever?
It's a really good question. I do think you need to know the rules to an extent before you throw them away. But I also often worry that we emphasize the writing rule book too much these days. And, you know, and it's a big risk not to know the writing rule book if you want to be published, actually, because I think an experimental novel can be more difficult to sell because it just carries greater risks. It's generally probably harder to sell. But that said, you know, an author has to serve the story in the end, which means taking risks and making your own rules. I think of William Faulkner, who's famous for the quote, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And I think if you're going to sum up all of his novels, that's all you need to know. You know, much of his work is difficult to read because he weaves in so many flashbacks and voices in his novels. And sometimes I think of his novels as a big kind of tangle of backstory that essentially immobilizes his characters or the story. But he had to take those narrative risks in order to serve his vision. And because he broke the rules of form, he created a world that I can literally feel. You know, it's just something that it changed my perception of the world as a result.
Yeah. And I liked that you used the word risk, because that is really what we're talking about, how to risk and to be fearless, but then doing that for the right reasons and the service to the story and what you're trying to create, and not just as an act of defiance or just because. It's funny that we're talking about teenagers, because I think sometimes teenagers do exactly that. They're being defiant because they want to shock, because they want to, you know, just be defiant or just because. And that is not exactly the kind of energy that you want to bring to your professional writing. You know, you want to bring this sense of what I was saying, the visionary, yes, I have something new that I'm going to experiment with. And writers can feel the difference between the two. You know, I can certainly feel the difference when I read writers' work and it feels like they're taking a chance versus when they're trying to be cute or, you know, I don't even know, messy sometimes. And then, like I said, they're making mistakes because they haven't bothered to learn. And I think that's one of the biggest criticisms around self-publishing, authors who are publishing before they're ready. And to me, that's the opposite of risk-taking. That's a form of negligence.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the title of the film, Rebel Without a Cause, kind of sums up what you're talking about. You want to rebel or take risks with a cause, right? Which hopefully is in service of your story and in service of reaching readers.
Totally.
So let's hear your green light moment this week, Brooke.
Yeah, well, the green light moment is in celebration of experimental writing. And I think when I think back anyway, Another Bullshit Night in Sex City was one of the first memoirs that I ever read that totally broke the rules. It's written in these short, sharp vignettes, and it doesn't really have chapters. And in many ways, it doesn't really have a plot. There's a lot of imagery and it's thematic and there's abstract ideas on the page. The author, Nick Flynn, is a poet, and that shines through as well. And I loved it. I was just like, oh my gosh, what is he doing? This is so amazing. And it really broadened my own understanding of memoir and has helped me to support unconventional memoirists ever since I read that book. And I've read a lot of experimental books that I've loved. I mean, Requiem for a Dream comes to mind, which is just a crazy experience if any of you have not read it. I think about A Million Little Pieces by James Frey, which despite the controversy surrounding that book is very experimentally written in terms of the dialogue and how he tells the story on the page. Michelle T is a local San Francisco author who's a rule breaker in form, the way she does dialogue and her unique voice. And then I think about Kwame Alexander, who was a guest on our show, who wrote a novel in verse. And he was such a rule breaker that the publishing industry didn't want anything to do with him at first. And now he's essentially trailblazed this entire new way of writing books for young people. And that is just awesome. I mean, that is a visionary. So the Green Light Moment is a celebration of these people who break the rules in service to form and voice, as we've been saying. And if you're looking for models for how to do this, then just start with some of the people I mentioned and look at how they do it, and then play and push your own boundaries and see what happens on the page and if it works. So Grant, what's your pep talk today?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning those examples of rule breakers, Brooke, because I think it's tough to break the rules by yourself sometimes. So even though defiance is often about going it alone and being headstrong and stubborn with your vision, there's a power in being a rule breaker within a community of other rule breakers, you know, just like those punk concerts I mentioned, where it was nice to see those other 103 punks in Iowa know they existed. So I'm going to urge listeners to find a community of like-minded rebels, or just to seek out mentors of rebellion, I guess. That's the way to put it. And since I mentioned William Faulkner, he had several mentors who helped shape his aesthetic, including the writer Sherwood Anderson, who persuaded him to write novels instead of poems, and also suggested he write about the region of Mississippi where he was raised. And mentors aren't just about shaping your craft, though. I think they're most important when they help you find who you are and what you can be. And I think of Sherman Alexie, who was drifting through his studies at Washington State University, and he randomly took a poetry workshop with Alex Quo, and that poetry workshop changed his whole entire notion of himself. He said that he read one line in a poem by the Peewit, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, poet Adrian C. Lewis, and that line changed his life. The line is, "I am in the reservation of my mind." And Alexie said it never occurred to him that a reservation Indian could speak out and be heard. And so Alex Quo modeled an engagement with literature and a political commitment that still guides Alexie today. And Alexie, in fact, calls him a father figure. So I think this is like one irony of being a rebel. We're all looking kind of to belong and find our people. So it's nice to have other rebels by your side.
That's right. And we can have our rebel yells and join each other in community and get out there and find our crew. So thanks for that, Grant. And we'll be right back with Abigail Thomas after our break. Hello, everybody. We are here today with Abigail Thomas. And Abigail is the author of 6 books, 3 works of fiction, and 3 memoirs. Her memoir, A Three-Dog Life, was named one of the best books of 2006 by the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post, and won the 2006 Books for a Better Life Inspirational Memoir Award. And her 2 other memoirs are Safekeeping and What Comes Next and How to Like It. She is the mother of 4 children and grandmother of 12, and she currently lives with her 3 dogs, who we might be hearing on today's show. And Abby's academic education stopped when she was pregnant with her oldest daughter and asked to leave Bryn Mawr during her first year. Abby started writing when she was 48 years old, which I also find inspiring. So Abby, hi, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. Thank you.
Last time I spoke with you, you were living with kids and grandkids and animals and trying to write your next book. And so before we even dive in, I want to ask, how is your writing life going these days? And are you finding the time to write your next book? And is your next book about the pleasures and pitfalls of being in your late 70s, as it was last time we spoke?
Yeah, it is. I'm having a really hard time making it into a book. I mean, I have all these little snatches of things, and it isn't adding up to much yet. So what I'm doing is taking some of the things I want very badly to write about and are difficult to write about and trying to make longer essays out of those.
Well, that's great to hear. And I'm glad, because I want to see more of your writing. And I wanted to just note this thing about the fact that you started writing in your late 40s and that now you are in your late 70s. I just think that age is something that no one really pays attention to until you start being sort of outside of the bounds, right? Like if you're really young or particularly old. And so how does age these days inform what you write about?
It's what I write about. It's absolutely fascinating to me. What you've left in the road behind you, what no longer makes you self-conscious, the joys of it, how interesting it is to talk to another elderly person about what hurts and what they take for it. There's so many interesting things, and all of the self-consciousness is gone. You can just say whatever you want. I think age is very interesting. My sister likes to say, you're much more concerned about being 77 than I am being 72, as though it's a bad thing. But it's, I think when you're a writer, whatever is at hand is what you're going to write about. And it is funny to be, because when I hear the word elderly, I immediately picture somebody frail and collarbones prominent and with a shock, wait, that's, I'm elderly. It's such a funny feeling. There was the weather was on the other day and it was wind chill factors for today and tomorrow. Most at risk, he said, children and the elderly. And it was a moment before I realized, holy shit, I'm the elderly. And it's so funny to be both elderly and me, you know, because I'm sort of the same person I've always been, only maybe a bit more so.
I'm just curious. I've been listening to you and I'm thinking about how I know you're fascinated by memory and this idea, and which comes with, I get more and more fascinated by memory the older I get, actually.
Well, it is interesting. Yeah.
And this idea of who memory belongs to. And I'm just curious about, since you've written three memoirs, can you tell us like what's drawn you to memoir and your take on memory, given that you teach about it and have probably thought about it a lot more than the average person?
Well, what's interesting about memory are the things that you do remember and then the things that you don't remember and then the things that you remember absolutely dead wrong. My first memoir, I didn't know I was writing anything. It was after my second husband died. We'd been divorced forever and become very, very close friends. And I'd known him since I was 27, and I guess I was in my 40s. And something inside of me, which I didn't even recognize, was saying, you have a past now. This is a moment demarking what used to be from what is going to be. And I just, these little things just came out of me. I didn't really know what they were, but they kept coming. And I, you know, you never mess with something that's got working. And it was a long time before I realized, like, oh my God, I think I'm writing something. And then it was very interesting because there were things I needed to do in the first person and things I needed to do in the third because I needed the distance and sometimes the second, and everybody turned it down. You know, my old editor at Algonquin wanted me to write a novel about this, and I haven't lived my life like a novel. My memory, I have a very good memory for what I remember, but it tends to be moments and not the interstitial material. You know, I remember things very well, but they don't have any. Yeah.
Well, sorry. Yeah, no, I was just going to jump in because it's a perfect segue into what I wanted to ask you about. I remember you having said last time we spoke that your life has been made up of a million different moments, or that people's lives are made up of a million moments, right? And that they don't neatly arrange themselves into chapters. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. And your memoirs are different, right? I mean, it's one of the reasons I love them so much. They're nonlinear. You don't worry about form so much. You write in spare prose at times, and you make the reader pay attention. And I've thought about whether your memoir writing in particular might be qualified as experimental. And I wonder if anyone has ever said that to you or if you've ever felt that way, and maybe if you could share a bit about what your process is like.
Well, the process was different for each memoir. The first one was really, it wasn't so much a process as it was paying attention to what was occurring to me and writing it down. I am very bored by chronology. I'm not interested in every bite of every sandwich chewed and swallowed at lunch. I'm just interested in the stuff that has emotional impact for me. And there is jumping around, you know, and I find that so interesting to be somewhere and write that that's happening right now. And then suddenly have a memory of 40 years ago. And that has to fit somewhere too. When I first wrote that, I thought it was going to end with Quinn's death. And then at a certain point I realized, but I'm not dead. I'm not dead. There's more here. And I had had an experience with my oldest daughter's first daughter's birth. And I wanted that to be the end. I wanted that to be the place I had to get to and figure out how I'm going to earn this ending. I hope I'm not really making sense, but, and that took me longer. That last chapter took me longer than writing the whole book.
I actually think that makes a lot of sense. I love the idea of earning an ending personally. And it's something more writers should aspire to do.
Well, you know, on the note of earning an ending, I know you used to be an editor, Abby.
Oh, yeah.
And you worked for a New York publisher. And I'm just curious, did you know that you wanted to write and publish back then? And what insight, you know, did being in that world give you into the world you now occupy, being a critically acclaimed published author who earns her endings?
Oh, that's so nice of you. That's actually a really interesting question. I had never thought myself capable of writing anything that I'd written poems, but I certainly wasn't a poet. And I couldn't imagine writing anything that went all the way across the page. But working with people, you know, you'd get a manuscript. There was a wonderful manuscript called French Dirt, and it didn't really work. It's I think it's still in print. And it was about a guy who had moved to France and made a garden. And the garden was the best part of this book, as I got it, was the little thing you say in the beginning. This is a story about love. This is not like love, you know. And then he says, "This is the story of my garden." And that was so perfectly put that I knew that even though it wasn't working, the regular part of the book, I knew we could do it because this was so good, and I just had to tease it out of him. You know, I just had to say, no, don't do this. Try this over here on the left, you know? And there were so many times when such inspiring, but not quite working manuscripts would come in, and with a little work, they would get good. And I think at some point I thought, oh gosh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can do this. But I, you know, you write and you look at it and you ball it up and, you know, throw it out, and who do you think you are? And then somebody told me a story that absolutely got me by the throat. It was so interesting. It was a story of her life and her mother and a funeral. And I wanted to write it so badly. And I wrote it and it was terrible. And so the story was more important than my ego. So I just tried again and again and again until I got it. And it wasn't until, and it got published right away, and it wasn't until I met her later that I realized I had stolen her story. I had written her story. And it was really humbling and shameful, but it was that story that got me writing.
That is interesting.
You don't always come out of this smelling like a rose. It was just, I had no idea that I was taking her story. It had just hit me so hard. And I made me the mother and made my children her. So it was different, but the bones of the story were exactly the same.
One of the things that strikes me, and we're talking about rule breaking today, and part of the reason is that when you and I spoke, when you taught a class for She Writes University, you were talking about all the things that you aren't bothered by, you know, chronology, theme, narrative arc, denouement.
And ooh, narrative arc, I hate that.
Well, and I saw you that day as a real rule breaker, you know, and I thought it would be a great theme for the show. And now you're talking about the ways in which you inadvertently break rules, you know, when you absorb someone's memory, for instance. And so I guess I'm wondering if you even consider yourself a rule breaker in the first place, but if you're not holding all those things in mind that are touted to be important, you know, by whomever, teachers and other folks, editors sometimes, then how do you decide what to write next?
I decide what to write next by what makes me hot, what's exciting to me. I'm not thinking, see, I didn't go to college, so I have no idea. I read a lot and then I started to write. I have no idea how to, that's why those words irritate me so much. I think almost the less you know, the better off you are, because you're not holding yourself up to things like narrative arc and denouement and all those words that mean absolutely nothing when you're writing about what's interesting to you. You know, there are things that, you know, you'll see a certain color blue and suddenly you'll remember the diner when you were in college for that brief moment in the blue light of the Blue Comet diner. And then you got a whole story there. One thing leads to another. I just write what I want to write. And I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to do anything in particular except have a really good time and be, and also sometimes an extremely painful time, and not make anything up. You know, it's just, I don't have to measure myself against anything because I don't know what it is.
I love that sensibility of writing, and just writing what you want to and taking delight in that. And I think there's something in the way you talk about writing that's very permission giving. So I really appreciate that. I wonder if there's any parting words of wisdom you might give to struggling memoirists out there. And I'll put novelists in that camp as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Any words of hope or encouragement, you know, because we all have to wrestle to get our story on the page.
Well, you know what? If you will allow yourself to write badly and not throw it away, just keep going. Because the way we learn is to do it wrong and then do it a little less wrong and try it. Never throw out your first draft, because that's where the fire is. Even if the words are going to change, that's where the fire is. And you have to go back to that and catch on again. You have to allow yourself to write badly before you can write well.
You sound like a spokesperson for NaNoWriMo. That's what we espouse. Get the words on the page. Don't worry about if they're good or bad. Find your story and tell it.
Yeah, I can't do that though.
You can.
Well, Abby, maybe I'll try it next November. I'll do my murder mystery.
We'll look for you.
Thank you.
I think that was a promise. So now I'm going to email you and make sure that you sign up.
And my dogs didn't say anything.
I know. I'm disappointed in them.
They're so good. I know. Look at them. Oh, well. Thank you very much. This was very nice of you. I'm afraid I'm a little, I can't speak in straight lines.
You speak how you write, and it's delightful. And so we are perfectly thrilled to have you and to share your words and your books too with everybody who's listening. I'm a huge fan. So thanks, Abby.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abby.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with this week's writing action.
So today's writing action is called Look for and Listen to the Unexpected. And it comes from Abigail herself, who says that when she is out and about, she's always looking for something unexpected, listening for something unexpected. And like many writers, she's an acute observer. And this is something that you can cultivate and do more of if you don't already do it. So next time you're out in the world, pay attention, get into the habit of noting the unexpected. You might start taking your journal with you the next time you're out and about the town or on a walk, or use your smartphone to take photos of things that leap out at you, says simply that, as unexpected. Practicing this opens up new possibilities in your writing because it's a unique way to invite delight and a sense of wonder and curiosity into your day-to-day life. And that can only positively impact your writing, regardless of your genre.
Yeah. And everyone, thanks for joining us. You can also listen to The Expected, which is the Right Minded podcast, which is we record every week. So we'll be right back next Monday. Please download it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can just give us a rating when you do so, that we'd be wonderfully, wonderfully happy, because that helps us get discovered and build an audience and talk to more writers. So we will see you next week.